From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
It's been one of the worst weeks for violence in Iraq since the invasion 2 years ago.
More than 150 people are dead in Iraq in a weekend of bloodshed. We'll go to Baghdad to speak with Patrick Coburn of the London Independent. And as Israel prepares for a possible ground offensive in Gaza and Hamas says it'll halt attacks, we speak with three women, Palestinian Christian, Muslim, and an Israeli Jew.
The conflict is not about religion. The fact that three faiths are presented here, the stories are different, but there is a common aim, which is to end occupation and the Israeli occupation of the Palestinians. And the fact that it's not about religious differences. It's about land. It's about the denial of human rights for a nation, the people.
That and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend marked one of the deadliest in Iraq since the U.S. invasion began more than 2 years ago. In 3 days of suicide attacks, more than 150 people have been killed, with nearly 300 wounded. The deadliest bombing came Saturday, when at least 98 people were killed and 130 injured in the town of Musayab after a suicide bomber blew up a fuel tanker near a crowded marketplace and in front of a Shia mosque. It was one of at least 10 bombings Saturday. Four more suicide bombs exploded in and around Baghdad Sunday, killing at least 20 people and wounding 19. A group identifying itself as al-Qaeda in Iraq claimed in an internet statement the bombings were part of a campaign to take control of the capital. So far this month, there have been more than 40 suicide attacks, which have claimed 269 lives and wounded 558. 17 of these bombings came in the past 72 hours in the Baghdad area alone. This comes as two new studies are casting serious doubt on President Bush's claims that the resistance in Iraq is made up of career jihadists who've seized on the opportunity to make Iraq their central front. The two investigations, one by the Saudi Arabian government, the other by an Israeli think tank, have found the vast majority of foreign fighters in Iraq are not former terrorists and became radicalized by the war itself. Both studies analyze the backgrounds and motivations of hundreds of foreigners entering Iraq to fight the United States. Amid the massive violence in Iraq, the Iraqi Special Tribunal set up to try Saddam Hussein announced the first official charges against him. Saddam and three others faced charges related to the alleged killings of about 150 Shiites in the Iraqi town of Dujail in 1982. The tribunal's chief investigating judge said at a news conference in Baghdad a date for the trial would be set within days. Saddam Hussein's lawyers say they have not been given a single document to investigate, and his lead lawyer says he's not seen his client in person since the late 1990s. One of the leading resistance leaders in Iraq has given a rare interview to the BBC. Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr told the BBC he supports the ongoing armed resistance against the U.S. occupation. Al-Sadr said, quote, resistance is legitimate at all levels, be it religious, intellectual, and so on. The first person who would acknowledge this is the so-called American President Bush, who said, if my country is occupied, I will fight. Al-Sadr says, quote, the occupation is itself a problem. Iraq not being independent is the problem, and the other problems stem from that, from sectarianism to civil war, he said. Iraq is set to have a new constitution unveiled on August 15th, but al-Sadr told the BBC he would not play any part in drafting that constitution or take on an official political role as long as the U.S. troops remain. The Bush administration has been forced to admit that in the months before the Iraqi elections in January, President Bush approved a plan to provide a covert support to certain Iraqi candidates and political parties. The admission comes in response to Seymour Hersh's forthcoming piece in the New Yorker magazine, where it reports the administration proceeded with the covert plan over congressional objections. A spokesperson from the National Security Council denied that, saying the administration rescinded the proposal because of congressional opposition. Hersh's article cites unidentified former military and intelligence officials who said the administration has gone ahead with covert election activities in Iraq that, quote, were concluded by retired CIA officers and other non-government personnel and used funds that were not necessarily appropriated by Congress. Any clandestine U.S. effort to influence the Iraqi elections would have run counter to Bush's assertions that the vote would be free and fair. Some of the covert support provided to Iraqi candidates and parties may have come through organizations such as the International Democratic Institute. Israel has massed thousands of troops along the border of the Gaza Strip and is threatening to invade unless the Palestinian Authority acts to prevent the firing of missiles at Israeli towns. Israeli Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon has instructed his military forces to show no restraint. In Gaza, residents were preparing for Israeli military action, speculating it might begin when Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice leaves after a short visit this week. Israel stopped all movement between the north, center, and south of Gaza and prevented men between the ages of 18 and 35 from crossing the border into Egypt. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas, who's in Gaza, made a televised speech over the weekend in which he reiterated his call for a single authority and a single armed force for Palestinians. Abbas said an Israeli invasion would, quote, sabotage everything. Meanwhile, Israel's assassinated another Hamas activist in Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip, said Saeed Sayam was said to be walking to his home of his father-in-law when he was shot in the chest and the neck. Witnesses said the shots had been fired from an Israeli military watchtower. As the British government continues its massive investigation into this month's coordinated London bomb attacks, one of Britain's most respected foreign policy think tanks is challenging Prime Minister Tony Blair's claim that the bombings were not a result of British involvement in the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. A new report by the Chatham House organization said the key problem in the UK for preventing terrorism is that the country is, quote, riding as a pillion passenger with the United States in the war against terror. The group is made up of leading academics and former government officials. On Saturday, Tony Blair said the bombers were driven by what he called an evil ideology rather than opposition to any policy. Blair called suggestions to the contrary a, quote, misunderstanding of a catastrophic order. But in its report, Chatham House concludes there is, quote, no doubt the invasion of Iraq has, quote, given a boost to the al-Qaeda network in propaganda, recruitment, and fundraising, while providing an ideal targeting and training area for terrorists. It goes on, quote, riding pillion with a powerful ally has proved costly in terms of British and U.S. military lives, Iraqi lives, military expenditure, and the damage caused to the counterterrorism campaign. The Sunday talk shows this weekend were dominated by the ongoing investigation into the outing of covert CIA operative Valerie Plame. One of those at the center of the story, Time magazine reporter Matt Cooper, appeared on NBC's Meet the Press, where he discussed his testimony in front of the grand jury. Cooper's also has an article published last night by Time in which he says President Bush's senior advisor, Karl Rove, was the first person to tell Cooper that Valerie Plame was a CIA officer. Cooper said he told that to a grand jury last week and that Rove ended the call by saying, quote, I've already said too much. Cooper wrote, Rove did not disclose Valerie Plame's name, but told him in July 2003 that information would be declassified that would cast doubt on the credibility of her husband, former diplomat Joseph Wilson. Cooper wrote, quote, so did Rove leak Plame's name to me or tell me she was covert? No. Was it through my conversation with Rove that I learned for the first time that Wilson's wife worked at the CIA and may have been responsible for sending him? Yes. Did Rove say that she worked at the agency on WMD? Yes. Cooper continues, quote, when he said things would be declassified soon, was that itself impermissible? I don't know. Is any of this a crime? Beats me, Cooper said. He wrote he had previously told the grand jury he'd also discussed Wilson and his wife with Louis Scooter Libby, Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff. He said he asked Libby about Wilson's wife playing a role in the Niger trip, and Libby replied, quote, yeah, I've heard that too. This all raises serious questions about whether several administration officials intentionally misled the public and investigators about the involvement of Libby and Rove. White House spokesperson Scott McClellan said in October 2003 that Rove, Libby, and another official had assured him they were uninvolved in the leak. Newly released documents confirm the FBI Counterterrorism Unit is monitoring activist websites used by coalitions for organizing protests at the 2004 political conventions in Boston and New York. The documents were released under the Freedom of Information Act in response to a lawsuit filed by a coalition of civil rights, animal rights, and environmental groups. One document from September 4, 2003, addressed to the FBI Counterterrorism Unit, described plans by the group RNC Not Welcome to, quote, disrupt the 2004 Republican National Convention in New York. It also described internet postings from the United for Peace and Justice Coalition, which was coordinating worldwide protests at the time. And a federal judge will sentence convicted Women's Health Clinic bomber Eric Rudolph to the first of four life terms today for deadly bombings in Birmingham and Atlanta. Today, he'll hear from some of his victims, the first of four such sessions. His Georgia sentencing is set for August 22nd. That's when victims of the Atlanta bombings also will have a chance to speak. Under a plea deal that let Rudolph avoid a possible death penalty, Rudolph admitted to an Alabama bombing and the bombing at the 1996 Atlanta Olympics that killed one woman and injured more than 100 people. And finally, former conservative British Prime Minister Edward Heath died Sunday of pneumonia. He was 89 years old. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Iraq is reeling from one of the bloodiest weekends since the U.S. occupation began over 2 years ago. Three suicide bombers hit Baghdad on Sunday following a deadly fuel truck bomb a day earlier that killed as many as 100 people. At around 8:30 p.m. Saturday evening, a man detonated an explosive belt in a crowded marketplace in the highway town of Musayib, 35 miles south of Baghdad. The explosion erupted just as a tanker containing cooking gas was passing by. The blast triggered an inferno that destroyed dozens of buildings, including a nearby Shiite mosque where worshippers were emerging from evening prayers. The death toll now stands at 100. Over 75 people were wounded in what is being called the second deadliest bombing since the war began in 2003. The attack prompted denunciations of the Iraqi authorities and parliament and calls for local militia to take up arms. On Sunday, four suicide bombs rocked Baghdad, killing at least nine people. All four attacks occurred within a span of 4.5 hours. On Friday, no less than 11 suicide bombers struck U.S. and Iraqi military targets in the capital and on the highway to the south, killing more than 33 people, wounding scores more. Three U.S. soldiers were also killed over the weekend. Patrick Coburn of the London Independent writes, quote, "It's not just the number of the dead and injured that makes the bombings in Baghdad so much worse than London. A single incident of danger is easier to endure than relentless attack and the knowledge that the bombers were here yesterday and tomorrow they will return again." Patrick Coburn joins us on the line from Baghdad. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to hear from you.
It's good to have you on. Can you talk about this weekend, what's described as the bloodiest weekend since the invasion more than 2 years ago?
Well, it keeps on saying that it can't get any worse here, but it keeps on happening. The suicide bombers, whom the U.S. general was telling us only a week ago, were might be heading, have been able to launch more attacks than I had ever seen. As you said, on Friday there were 11. Everybody's very nervous, terrified in Baghdad. Traffic is down. A lot of people don't go to the office or where they work till 10 o'clock because most of the attacks occur around 9, although they happen later in the day as well. So there's a mood of pretty unrelenting fear in the capital.
Patrick Coburn, the feeling right now in Baghdad about the administration in the United States, a discussion, as I know there is in Britain, of a, quote, timetable. The Bush administration has rejected this, although new documents have come out indicating London and Washington are considering this. What are people demanding in Baghdad?
They're demanding two different things. If you ask anybody in the street here, they all want the U.S. troops out of Baghdad, out of the cities. Occasionally you come across somebody who says it should be two stages, Baghdad and then the rest of the country. But it's almost a universal opinion on the street that the U.S. troops should withdraw. They blame them for the continuing violence. They say that when U.S. convoys are attacked, they immediately fire all directions. Now, it's a different, if you go inside the green zone, talk to official members of the government, they feel that if there was a withdrawal now, that large parts of the country, large parts of Baghdad would immediately fall to the resistance. And they say, for instance, about a week, 10 days ago, in South Baghdad, there's a district called Dora, that one morning about 5 a.m., the insurgents simply took over the whole place. The police either fled or stayed inside their police stations. They say that could happen in the whole of Baghdad.
You have written, Patrick Coburn, about the Seymour Hersh expose in the New Yorker magazine, about Americans, the Bush administration, accused of interfering in the Iraqi election. The response from Baghdad.
Well, I think that everybody in Baghdad, everybody in Iraq, thought that the U.S. was supporting Iyad Alawi, the prime minister, in the election in January. It was never clear where the money, and he had a lot of money, was coming from. And so it doesn't have too many surprises for me, the article in the New Yorker. I think what's surprising was at the end of the day it was pretty pretty ineffective that Alawi didn't get the vote that he'd been hoping for. Yeah, certainly there was interference in the election, and but I think that really was something that Iraqis had taken on board before the rest of the world.
Patrick Coburn, you are in Baghdad. You come from London. The bombings there and the bombings in Iraq. Can you talk about the comparisons that you wrote about?
Well, there were four bombs in London, and this has created a general outrage. It's perfectly understandable. This is something that hasn't happened before. But, you know, four bombs in Baghdad in a single day is practically a good day. Secondly, it's frightening though those bombs in London were. It's, and I've spent quite a long time in places like Belfast and Beirut, and I've always found this to be true. It's not that difficult to endure something very violent happening over one day. But if it happens day after day, week after week, and you know that there's no reason it should stop, that really is much more difficult to bear. And I think that the Iraqis are finding that, the knowledge that, you know, whatever happens tomorrow, we have one thing is certain, there are going to be a lot more suicide bombs. But that's not easy for them. It wouldn't be easy for anybody.
I wanted to get your response, Patrick Coburn, to the Chatham House organization in London, their new report saying that the bombings, objecting to Blair's claim that the bombings were not a result of British involvement in the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yes, of course, they're quite right. And, you know, it's a matter of common sense. I think it's also something that polls show that most people in Britain see that there's a very direct connection between Iraq and Afghanistan and what's happened and the bombs in London. This has put Britain in the forefront of a battle. It's raised the political temperature. It's always made it quite likely that Britain would be the target of suicide bombers. I mean, to say that there's no connection between the war in Iraq and these bombs, I think is very simple-minded. And I don't suppose that Tony Blair or any of his cabinet really believe this. They know that indirectly Iraq was very important in what happened.
Patrick Coburn, I want to thank you for joining us with the London Independent, speaking to us from Baghdad, Iraq. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, three women, a Palestinian Christian, Muslim, and an Israeli Jew. Stay with us.
كان في مرة طفل صغير عم يلعب بالحارة عم بيفتش ع خيطان طير طيارة وتطلع بالجو وقال مدري شو عم يلمع شوفوا شوفوا طيارة جاي لعندي الطيارة.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 350 radio and television stations around the country, on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, and 9410 Link TV, and DirecTV Channel 375. We're podcasting, and our headlines are in Spanish on our website at democracynow.org, where we also video and audio stream. I'm Amy Goodman. A weekend of violence in Gaza threatened to topple a five-month-old truce and derail plans for the August pullout of Jewish settlements and soldiers. The Israeli military massed tanks on the edge of Gaza Sunday in preparation for a possible ground offensive. Hamas said today it'll honor the truce, reserving the right to, quote, resistance and self-defense. This follows a pledge from Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas that he'll do all he can to stop rocket and mortar attacks on Jewish settlements. Last Tuesday, a Palestinian suicide bomber killed four Israelis in the town of Netanya, and Hamas has launched more than 100 rockets at Israeli targets in Gaza over the past several days. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said despite the truce, there would be, quote, no restriction on our activities to halt attacks at communities both inside and outside the Gaza Strip. The Israeli Defense Forces renewed their practice of targeting individual Palestinian leaders. Sunday, an Israeli sniper shot dead a local Hamas leader, Saeed Siam, outside his house. And army personnel shot and killed a Palestinian man approaching the Jewish settlement of Netzarim. On Friday, Israeli helicopter gunships fired a missile at a minibus in Gaza City, killing four Palestinians. Well, today we turn to a conversation about the daily realities of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Three women, a Christian, a Muslim, and a Jew, traveled throughout the United States last month to share their experiences with American audiences. Dr. Juman Odeh, Muslim-Palestinian, lives in Jerusalem as director of Palestinian Happy Child Center. She supervises child health programs in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and Jerusalem. Michal Sagi is a Jewish Israeli who serves as the executive director of Shiloh, Jerusalem's Family Planning, Educational, and Counseling Center. She's active with Checkpoint Watch, a women's human rights monitoring group, which monitors reports on its observations at Israeli military and police checkpoints in West Bank and East Jerusalem. Also, Rana Khoury, a Christian Palestinian, lives in Bethlehem, deputy general director of the International Center of Bethlehem, a Palestinian NGO. Her father died in January of 2004 when he was denied passage in Israeli checkpoint on the way to the hospital because he was not holding a sickness permit to attest to his massive heart attack. Even his American passport was not able to get him to a Jerusalem hospital. We began with Dr. Jumana Odeh, Michal Sagi, and Rana Khoury when they came into our firehouse. Dr. Odeh began by talking about the situation of the children she works with.
Although it sounds happy, but Palestinian children are going through very difficult circumstances. And to be a doctor, the most frustrating, actually, when you feel that you can't do anything for a sick baby or a sick child coming to your center. And the minute they arrive with their parents or mainly with their mothers, you don't ask the regular questions any physician on earth will ask. How are you doing? And then you go directly to signs and symptoms and ask about the health of the child. You ask, how did they arrive? How many checkpoints and roadblocks they had to go through, how many hours it took them to reach the center, and much more questions than any other doctor will ask in other situations. Besides that, you have to be aware of their psychosocial other aspects rather than only medical, pure medical aspects. How much did it cost them to reach because of the long distances they have to go through? It is becoming so harsh for people to reach. Besides that, the economical situation is too harsh for Palestinians. Then you go to the core issue, which is the health. I wrote once a story about a child during the invasion of Ramallah, because actually I'm from Jerusalem, but I live in Ramallah and Jerusalem, not only in Jerusalem. And I work mainly in Ramallah, so I have to go and come from Ramallah to Jerusalem and the opposite directions. And once when Ramallah was under siege, I had to stay in Ramallah all the way through because I'm needed there. Like many other doctors, we were needed in the city. And I remember that the curfew was lifted. There was a long curfew for almost 3 weeks. Then the curfew was lifted for only 2 hours. And you imagine what can you do within 2 hours. And I got lots of calls from my patients, especially that particular child who was around 6, and he had epilepsy. And they ran out of their anti-epileptic drugs, and they lived in a village next to Ramallah. So his father was calling, pleading for help, that they tried to enter Ramallah because the curfew was lifted only for 2 hours. They were not allowed to enter Ramallah within those 2 hours. And he was asking for medication. And he told me that my child is seizuring. He's fitting. He's having his seizures on the checkpoint, right on the checkpoint while the soldiers were watching, and they are not allowing me. So I had to jump into that checkpoint, run to that checkpoint, give him the medication, calm down the child. And I remember him telling me, please, I don't want to fall down again. I don't want to fall down again. I will never, ever forget this story.
How old was the boy?
He was around 5 and a half, 6.
What happens at the checkpoint? Can you describe when it's a family trying to get to the doctor?
You know, first of all, I can give another story about what does it mean for me, even personally. You know, yes, I'm a doctor. Yes, I have special permits to pass. Yes, I am Jerusalemite, so it's much easier for me to go from one place to another. And I can't compare myself with other people who suffer much more than I do. And always I compare myself with somebody, with a mother carrying her disabled child and going through hell. But lately, my father, 1.5 years ago, was diagnosed of having cancer, and he's from Ramallah. So he needs a special permit to go to Jerusalem because his treatment wasn't available in Ramallah. We have to go to Jerusalem, and only in one of the Israeli hospitals we found his treatment. So hopefully that I could do this permit for him to go and come. And this permit's supposed to be only for patient, only for him as a patient, and only for 1 day. Then later on, I could make it, with the help of the hospital, I could make it for 2 months or 3 months, and hopefully that the professor that he's treating him, and I really admire this woman, and I want to acknowledge her name. Her name is Professor Dina Bin Yehuda, and she's the head of hematology department at Hadassah in Karem Hospital. She was of a great help. She saved the life of my dad. And again, I will never forget her and what she did to my dad. And she's the minute we are in the hospital, as my dad, as a patient and a daughter, and everybody is taking her chemotherapy, we sit together, Arabs and Israelis, in one room. By time, we become like family, you know. If somebody is complaining, everybody will go and try to help and ask about her health. And everybody's so friendly with my dad, the nurses, the doctors, everybody. And always I wonder, if we can share this pain together, why don't we share joy too? So these are very painful stories, yet I do believe that peace will come one day. Because there are some people, and many, I believe, within Israeli system and within Israeli community, like Professor Bin Yehuda and many other friends, and like Michal, like many other friends who go to Mahsoum Watch, which is the checkpoint watch, and they are very helpful. And many other doctors and professors that I know within the health community in Israel.
Dr. Jumana Odeh lives in Jerusalem, works in Ramallah and back and forth, is a physician, and describing going across the checkpoint, Muslim-Palestinian woman, the checkpoint, which brings us to Michal Sagi, who is an Israeli Jew who spends a lot of time at checkpoints. Why?
I need to go there. I cannot ignore the things that are happening, the things that are being done by using my name, my citizenship, I feel the need to witness and not to be able to say I didn't know, I didn't see. So
describe a checkpoint for us.
A checkpoint is not like here in the airport where someone is wants to go in and is being checked for security, but nobody questions his or her right to go on board. In the military checkpoints around the West Bank and around Jerusalem, the soldiers can decide who is going to pass and who is not going to pass. On top of that, the majority of checkpoints are not between Israelis and Palestinians. Most of the checkpoints are separating a Palestinian village from a Palestinian town. So if, let's say that you are living in Hawar village, which is southern to Nablus, and you want to get to Nablus in order to get dentist treatment or for shopping or for university, school, whatever, the daily needs that one need, they should go out in the morning early. They would stand at a checkpoint, sometimes for hours, without knowing if they're actually going to make it, if they're actually going to pass it. Because the rules are keeping, they keep changing the rules. One day, everybody are allowed in, and the next day only people over 35 are allowed. One day students can go inside to university, and one day no. People are being detained for hours for checking, but also as a mean of punishment. And
what about you? Can you go back and forth?
No, actually. I can get to the checkpoint. I cannot cross it inside what we call Areas A, which was during the back during Oslo agreements are considered to be Palestinians' areas under Palestinian authority. So I cannot go there. I can go to B and C. B is where the, in terms of... it's civilian stuff is under Palestinian Authority, and militarily it's under the Israeli army's responsibility.
How does the Israeli military treat you?
Us, the women of Mahzom Watch?
The women of Checkpoint Watch.
They got used to us. They were amazed at first. Hey, what are you doing here in the middle of nowhere? We really go inside... inside the territories into distant checkpoints, and they're at first amazed to see us there. Then they are very disturbed by our presence. They sometimes very rude, sometimes not. One soldier once told me, "Thank you for helping, for reminding me what it's all about." And some tell us you are being ungrateful, traitors, go away. So it's various, but they would prefer us not to be there.
What have
which
you
is exactly why we should be there.
And have you witnessed anything that you intervened in?
Yes, let me tell you a story which is not a big drama. It's a small story because that's what it's all about. It's not a big drama. Those get into the news. I've been to Kalandia checkpoint, and
where is that?
That's southern to Ramallah, northern to Jerusalem, and it's a checkpoint that many people are crossing daily because, like Dr. Odess said, they're going to Ramallah to work and they live in East Jerusalem or vice versa. And it's a big checkpoint, again, in the middle of a Palestinian neighborhood, Kalandia, actually a refugee camp. And there is another checkpoint further towards Jerusalem, so why to have two? But that's a different question. So anyway, I met a teacher there. She lives in Jerusalem, teaches in Ramallah. She left in the morning. Everything was fine. She was allowed to cross. When she came back, they declared a siege or something similar to that, and she couldn't go back. When I met her, it was the third day that the siege was held, and for 3 days she came to the checkpoint, couldn't cross, went back to stay with friends in Ramallah. Their kids, her husband, was back home in East Jerusalem. I approached the officer, and I said, listen, she's trying for 3 days now to go back home, and she has a permit. She's allowed to cross back and forth, according to the army's law. And he said, yes, I know, I'm sorry. Those are the rules. Today, only humanitarian cases are allowed. So I got back to her. I apologized. I said, listen, I tried, but I didn't manage to help out. And then she said, you know, I didn't change for 3 days. Got back to the officer and asked him, would he consider not changing for 3 days a humanitarian case? And he was like looking at me, and he let her through. So it's a little story. It's not a big drama. And these are the things that we manage to do. We don't manage to do much. The soldier is not, they're not going to change the rules that are so sacred to them because of me. But everyone, in a while, we manage to make them rethink or to question the axioms, which is basically what we're trying to do with the Israeli society and the public opinion all over the world. We're trying to make people to question the axioms. And that's why we report, and we have written reports on our website.
What's your website?
It's machsomwatch.org, machsomwatch.org, in one word. And all of our reports, we report twice a day from various checkpoints. We have two shifts a day. And it's after a few days, it's on the web.
How many people involved, and are you all women?
We are all women, and at the moment we're around 500 women. We have a group up north monitoring the checkpoints around Jenin city. We have the original group in Jerusalem monitoring checkpoints around Jerusalem, and into the West Bank we get to, as I said, Nablus and to Hebron on the other side, and we have a group down south and in Tel Aviv.
Did you serve in the military?
Yes, I did.
What did you do?
That was so many years ago. I've been a teacher. If there's anything positive that the Israeli army is doing is giving education to underprivileged youth in Israel to bring them to a minimum standard of education, and I was teaching those guys.
Michal Sagi is with Checkpoint Watch, a women's human rights group that monitors checkpoints in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. We're also joined by Rana Khoury, who is in Bethlehem, lives there, but did her college and graduate education here at University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Here the three of you are. You're a Palestinian Christian. Dr. Jumana Odeh is a Palestinian Muslim, and Michal Sagi is an Israeli Jew. Why are you in the United States? Why did you come back?
You mean on this tour? I think for a number of reasons. One is to show that the conflict is not about religion. The fact that three faiths are presented here, the stories are different, but there is a common aim, which is to end occupation and the Israeli occupation of the Palestinians. And the fact that it's not about religious differences. It's about land. It's about the denial of human rights for a nation, a people.
Rana Khoury and Dr. Jumana Odeh, Michal Sagi, with us in the studio. We'll be back with them in a minute. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to three women, an Israeli Jew, a Palestinian Muslim, and Christian. Rana Khoury is the Christian Palestinian who lives in Bethlehem. I asked her if she was an American citizen.
It doesn't matter. There are different classes of an American. I have a Palestinian ID. Mm-hmm. And once I enter into Israel and Palestine, I cease to be an American citizen, and so I cannot use my American passport to travel freely. And so I am basically in the town of Bethlehem. If I need to go to Jerusalem, I need to apply for a permit, and that's very difficult to get. Not too many people get those permits. And so even if I wanted to meet with Michal or to go to Ramallah, for example, a city that is 40 minutes drive away from Bethlehem, it would take me 4 to 5 hours. So I have to really think about going. And that's the situation. And so even if we want to meet after this tour, it's going to be a very challenging experience.
What about you as two Palestinian women, one Muslim and one Christian? Is your experience in the West Bank of the occupation any different in terms of, are you treated differently?
No,
I don't think so. Actually,
Dr. Adeh.
I don't think so that there's any difference between Muslims or Christians in a way the occupiers treat. They treat everybody alike. So even maybe I don't know, Rana's experience is really sad, and I have lots of friends in Bethlehem who can't reach Jerusalem, and from many other towns of the country that they can't go to Jerusalem. So maybe I'm a bit lucky that I'm Jerusalemite. Beside that, I'm a doctor. It's a bit easier for us to fight for the right of a doctor-patient relation in order to pass. But there's no different because of the religion.
The image in the United States is that there is persecution of Palestinian Christians by the Muslim Palestinians, which is completely ridiculous. I mean, the fact is, and the perception is based on the fact that there is a very high immigration rate amongst Palestinian Christians, but that goes back to other factors. But mainly it has to do with Israeli occupation and not with the fact that Palestinian Christians are being persecuted. They're not. And Dr. Ode perhaps was referring, I mean, when we talk about checkpoints, it's a very personal experience with myself, because I feel that the checkpoints were responsible partly for the death of my father. Again, an American citizen. And a year and a half ago, he had a massive heart attack, and he was to be transferred for a hospital in East Jerusalem because there are no good health system in the West Bank or in Palestinian cities and areas. And at the checkpoint, he was held for 4 hours the man was almost dead. And the reason why he was held was the fact that he had the wrong permit. He's a hotel owner, and he has a permit that as a merchant, meaning he goes into East Jerusalem or in Israel as a merchant. And on that day, because there was a closure that merchants could not go in Jerusalem, he needed a medical permit. The man was in an ambulance. For 4 hours, he was held at a checkpoint between Bethlehem and Jerusalem. And then the only way to solve the matter after 4 hours of trying to connect to people was to call an ambulance from Jerusalem, where he was transported from that ambulance of the West Bank to an ambulance in Jerusalem in order to go to a hospital.
How do you get a medical permit if you're in a crisis?
Yeah. Well, that's another challenge as well. Because in order to get a permit, you need to travel on a bypass road. Bypass road meaning mainly it's for Jewish-only settlers. And you need to travel on that road in order to get to a military
headquarters and Israeli military headquarters in order to apply. And that in itself is a long procedure. You can go from 5 o'clock in the morning and get back at 5 o'clock in the evening several days in a row in order to get a permit. And to get a permit, it's not very easy. It's not like you need medical reports. You need, for a medical, if you need a permit to go as a worker, you hardly get that, and so on and so forth. So there has to be a very valid reason why would you need a permit to go into a place like East Jerusalem.
Dr. Juman Odeh, how many people die at checkpoints?
You know, there were many women give birth at checkpoints. The latest statistics that there were 39 babies died on the checkpoints.
Died.
Not only delivered. I mean, around, I think, 70-something, they were delivered at the checkpoint. This is from the beginning of Intifada. But many, the reason why it's not only checkpoints, as Rana mentioned, medically speaking, heart attack might be tackled. In good hospitals, it might be tackled. But there was one reason, which is the heart attack for death, but another reason why to hold a patient for 4 hours. This is no explanation. I can't explain, you know. Again, with the some cases or women who deliver who delivered on checkpoints because they needed more help. That's why they had to reach to try to reach hospitals. Otherwise, they deliver in their homes or with the help of TBAs, traditional birth attendants, or doctors or nurses within their community. It is available those days, and we had to adapt. Actually, when Rana was talking, in medical community, we are having new phenomena like back-to-back ambulance. This is back-to-back, which means from one ambulance will come from the West Bank and one from Jerusalem, and then you transfer your patients from one on the checkpoint.
So they don't care about the patient; they care about which ambulance the patient
yes,
is driving.
Yes. So you have to transfer your patient from one ambulance to another, back by back.
By the way,
what's that?
It's the same
goods.
The same system work for goods. That there are checkpoints that are not for pedestrians, but only for goods, for flour, sugar, oil, and a truck comes from the Palestinian side, and truck brings the food, for example, from the Israeli side, and then back to back they transfer the things from one truck to another, and then now they apply it also to human beings, to ambulances.
Yeah, actually, the argument is, why is that? Is it for the security of Israeli people? I'm with the security of Israeli people. I mean, I wish that one day all Israeli kids will go to their schools peacefully and with no fear of entering any bus. At the same time, I wish and I dream that one day will come for Palestinian kids to go to their schools peacefully and with dignity. The issue is it has nothing to do with security reasons. I give one example. When I apply, like many other people, apply for a permit for a sick person, like my dad, who's 80 years old, and he's sick, and he needs a treatment. We go to Israeli system, we pay for it. It is privately we do it. So, yeah. But why this all long procedure? It's just to humiliate people more and more and more. I remember first time I went for his permit, I waited maybe 45 minutes, and I started crying. I couldn't take it. There was no explanation. The minute I come close to the, not only me, there are many hundred people do the same. The minute I'm close to the window, the soldiers start shouting, go back, go back, go back. Okay, once, twice, three. How many times you can be humiliated at once, systematically? Second time, I were a bit equipped. I took my book with me. So it took me around 1.5 hours, and then I cried. I couldn't take it. Third time, I decided, no, I'll go equipped. I'll have a good book to survive this, and I call it antidote to the occupation. Yeah, and my water. And I said my main aim is to get this permit, bloody permit. That's why I could survive three hours waiting for the permit, and I didn't cry. It doesn't mean that we get used to this humiliation. Nobody likes to be humiliated. We are human beings. The issue is that you find your ways to survive. Is it resilient? Is it that this is a coping mechanism? We try, and this we find a lot with children. We notice it with children, and I'm sometimes amazed how they can cope with all that, with all this pressure. So it is. There's no answer except that this is systematic humiliation in order to kill the spirit of Palestinian people. There's no other explanation to that.
Michal Sagi, as we listen to these stories, what is the perception in Israeli society of what is going on in the occupied territories, and especially at the checkpoints? Do they know the stories of Rana Khoury's father? Do they know the stories of the patients of Dr. Johanna Adeh?
Some of them knows, most of them don't know, most of them don't want to know. It's hard to witness. Most of the Israelis think that the checkpoints are a necessary evil, and that they don't look nice and they don't give us a good reputation in the world, but we don't have a choice.
Why not?
That's the Israeli point of view. It's not my point of view.
And why they say there's no choice?
Because they believe that with the checkpoint, the Israel is defending its citizens. With the checkpoints and the wall that is being built is the same. Israelis really believe that will give them security.
And that wall, just a quick description. I know any one of you could do it.
8 meters high. Enclaves the whole Palestinian area, the whole West Bank, cutting the West Bank into pieces. Rana gave yesterday a good metaphor.
I said that we have become Swiss cheese. The fact that the Israelis are taking the cheese and the Palestinians get the holes. And this is basically what, I mean, for example, I come from Bethlehem, and Bethlehem at this point is being encircled by, it's a 26-foot-high wall, much higher than the Berlin Wall. And it's circling Bethlehem from three parts, the north, the west, and the east, and the south. And then the east is the bypass road. And so if we can talk about something in two words, it's an open-air prisons. That's the towns. It's prisons with, for example, in the case of Bethlehem, three gates, two for people, one for merchandise. So the same sort of concept, that Palestinians are not human. The merchandise gets the gate all on its own. Many kids will be living between walls, so that at this point they're talking about tunnels for the children to go to their schools from the area that is between walls into the city through what they are calling humanitarian tunnels.
There is a movement in the United States on college campuses to cut off, call for the cutoff of aid to Israel, stop doing business with companies that do business with Israel. As the Israeli here, Michal Sagi, what is your response to that? Do you support that?
We Israelis, and I am Israeli, part of the Israeli society, care deeply for Israel and its future, and that this is exactly why I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm very pro-Israeli. I'm not pro the policy, but I'm very pro-Israeli. So I know that it's going to be very hard for Israel if countries and companies will start boycotting us. But I think that we need a certain amount of pressure to go forward. We need a third party to get involved, but in a fair way.
What do you mean, but in a fair way? What about the role of the U.S. right now?
In a fair way means to acknowledge the rights of Palestinians and to negotiate eye to eye, in eye level, not to patronize, not to decide for the other what is good for them, but to really sit around a round table and not otherwise. Obviously, the States is more towards the Israeli policy,
meaning the United States.
Yeah, I'm not using the terminology of being they're not being pro-Israeli, because again, I don't think that this is pro-Israeli. I think that it harms Israel, continuing the occupation, destroying Israeli society. It's harming us severely. We are corrupting a second and third generation by occupying another nation. And by the way, I think it's going to happen to you as well. But that's, again, a different story.
Meaning
you cannot occupy a civil society and control a civil society and stay human and stay democratic and stay good human being.
And you're talking about?
Iraq.
The U.S. occupation,
yeah,
of Iraq. What do you hope to accomplish with this tour right now? What do you see as a realistic solution? And what do you think of Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader? What do you think of Ariel Sharon, the Israeli leader? Who wants to take that on?
Michal. In terms of what I'm hoping to accomplish in that tour is mostly to let people know, or at least to let people understand that they should get more information and that they shouldn't trust whatever they hear. They should go and seek the information for themselves in, for example, independent websites, not believe whatever the media, Israeli media or American one for that matter, is giving them, because it's not always what is really happening. So mostly to get awareness and to get people to ask some question. And doing it together brings a different voice, which is not very often heard, a voice that says it can be done. We can do it. It has to do with goodwill. It has to do with realizing that there's more than me in the story. There's me and you, and some other little changes in the way we think, and it can be done.
Michal Sagi is an Israeli Jew with Checkpoint Watch, Rana Khoury, a Christian Palestinian who lives in Bethlehem, and Dr. Jumana Odeh, a Muslim Palestinian, lives in Jerusalem and works in the occupied territories. Three women talking about life under occupation. You can go to our website to get more information at democracynow.org. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Also special thanks to Nell Geiser, Maddie Harper, and Susie Salami. Our cameramen today are John Randolph, Orlando Richards, Tyshawn Black. Special thanks to Angela Alston, Uri Galed, our director, and Chris Zucker. At our website, you can sign up for our daily digest. Get our headlines every day at democracynow.org. Also there, you can get our program video and audio streaming, and as well, you can get contacts for our guests. We are also broadcasting in Spanish on our website, and we are podcasting. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!